Now, the first idea, which I had mentioned previously, which is very important to know, is the idea of tzimtzum, which means restriction. And that is that since we know one of the aspects of the Ribbono Shel Olam is that Einei Mevadoi, which really means that only He exists, and that even though we exist, it's not like His, so compared to His existence, we don't really exist. So therefore, what that really means is that in the beginning, when the Ribbono Shel Olam was completely manifested throughout, if somehow He had left things unchanged, then nothing could exist by definition. Since God is Einei Mevadoi, if He was manifesting Himself completely throughout the aspect of His Einei Mevadoi, that only He exists, obviously nothing can be created, because there would be a Yeshei Mevadoi if there was. So what the Ribbono Shel Olam did is that He was Metzamtzem Himself, which means that He concealed part of the aspect of His oneness, that only He exists. And as a result of that concealment, what came into existence, of course, was a possibility that other beings besides Him could also now exist. So therefore, the first act of Tzimtzum is the idea that Ribbono Shel Olam concealed or He hid the idea that He only exists, and therefore other beings were now able to be created besides Him. Now, we again don't know how or what happened, how the Ribbono Shel Olam does that, whatever, but the idea is that by doing this, by concealing the idea of Einei Mevadoi, of His soul unity, existence, He now is able to bring other beings into existence. That is the idea of Tzimtzum. Now, the different operations, which I'll mention now, of this Tzimtzum can be looked at sort of like six different categories. The first idea is the subject. The second idea is the mechanism, how He does what He wants to do. The third idea is the actual operation. What does the individual do? The fourth idea is the effect of the operation. As a result of this operation, which came through this mechanism, there's a certain effect. What was the immediate effect of the operation? The fifth idea is the result. What is the general results of this operation? And the sixth idea is the manifestations. How does it manifest itself to people? So if we could look at in those six ideas, let's now go back and look at Tzimtzum and see the different acts that happened. The first act that happened was that Hashem, of course, is the subject. His mechanism, of course, is His will, and that's about all we know. That's how He does what He wants to do. The operation that He did was Tzimtzum, that somehow He concealed His Yehudah, His absolute oneness. And the effect of that was what? Was a hester of that Yehudah. There was a concealment of that aspect of His unity. That was the effect. The results, of course, of that is that it is now possible for other beings to exist as a result of the fact that He hid His unity. And of course, the manifestation, of course, is the possibility itself. The possibility that beings itself could now exist happened because He was master of His Yichud as a result of His Tzimtzum, by way of His will, and that's what He did. See, it's just a logical progression. That's the first act of Tzimtzum. The next act of Tzimtzum is He decided that what kinds of being will He create. So the beings that He will create is really inferior to what He could have done. Because if God created beings in accordance with what He could do, His own power, then nobody could understand the creation except He Himself, because the creation would be infinite. Therefore, He created beings which were not infinite or finite, so that they could comprehend the acts of God itself. So the second act of Tzimtzum means that He restricted, let's again go through the six. Who is the subject now? The subject now is the Ribbono Shel Olam. God Himself is the subject. The mechanism, how He did it, of course, is His will. The operation, again, is Tzimtzum, right? And the effect of that operation is further Hester. So He hid more of His unity And the result would be that there are now beings created at a certain level of his power, right? And these beings would be deficient in terms of perfection found in God, but they would be perfect in themselves. God created beings which were perfect in themselves. In other words, the beings he created has a certain capacity of existence, a certain kind of existence, and he created them that way, that kind of existence, and as a result of the fact that he created them that way, they therefore manifest that existence. So in effect, the second act of Tzimtzum was nothing more than the creation of beings which are not like him, they're not perfect like him, but they themselves, in as far as the capacity that they could be, they are perfect. Okay? So the subject, of course, was the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. The mechanism was his will. The operation was another Tzimtzum, a second act of Tzimtzum. That was the operation. The effect of that operation is a further hester in the universe, greater hester yichudo, right? The result of that is a universe or beings that now exist far inferior to what the Ribbono Shel Olam could have done, but they exist in the terms of their full capacity. They are actually and potentially the same. And the manifestation of that is the spiritual universe. So in other words, there are two acts of Tzimtzum so far, right? The first act was to hide his presence so that there's a possibility of other beings to exist. That's the first act of Tzimtzum. And the second act of Tzimtzum is that the beings that were created only with a certain amount of perfection, not like his, and not the, what he could have done, but at a certain level. And I used an example, the 50% level, which of course is an example, that's all. It was he created beings 50% of what he could have done, as an example. And the manifestation of that is the spiritual universe. Malachim and so on, these beings were created perfect in their own selves. Not perfect like God, or not even perfect the way he could have created. He could have made 90% power, beings that reflecting 90% of his ability. But he didn't. He made, let's say, 50%. But at least that the beings he made, which reflects 50%, is perfect in that capacity. They have a certain capacity to exist, based on the amount of hester in the universe. Remember, that's the effect of the Tzimtzum operation. So therefore they exist at 50%, actually, potentially and actually. That's the spiritual universe. That's the second act of Tzimtzum. Let's take a look at the third act of Tzimtzum. The third act of Tzimtzum, again, is who's the subject, who's doing the operation? God, Ribbono Shel Olam. Again, the mechanism is his will. What's the operation? Tzimtzum. Tzimtzum, we know, is nothing more than the activation of Hester Yechudei. That's all it is. So the effect, of course, is now, after restricting himself, so to speak, with his now greater Hester, in other words, removing his presence, we now find the immediate effect, of course, is Hester. So the immediate effect, of course, is Hester Yechudei in a greater extent than was present on the second Tzimtzum. But the modern thing here is that some interesting, the result of that was an interesting kind of being. What was that? That the Ribbono Shel Olam created a kind of being really at the 80% level in potential. But when he actualized them, he made them at 20%. So that they're not even perfect in terms of themselves, let alone in terms of him, or let alone in terms of the Malachim. In other words, the Ribbono Shel Olam creates, the second act of Tzimtzum is to create, let's say, beings at 50%, and they reflect their total shlemus, their total capacity. That means that being is shalem, shlemus, complete, in terms of what they could be. So they are only, they lack perfection, not in terms of themselves, but in terms of God himself. The third act of Tzimtzum is this, that he brings about the operation of Tzimtzum as a result of his will. The effect, of course, is Hester. But what are the results of this Hester? That he creates an entity which is really 80% capacity, but in actuality is only 20% of his powers. He splits it, which he did to no other beings. He split mankind itself. That the capacity of mankind is 80%, if he gets there, which is greater than the Malachim. other words, the shleimus of the Adam is far greater than the Malachim, but the actuality of man is not 80%, it's 20%, which is much less than Malachim. So in other words, you find that there's a split, that he creates a new being that does not reflect his full capacity. So that being is now choser, deficient. Not in terms of the deficiency of the way God created, but in terms of deficiency in terms of his own capacity. And not only is it man that's deficient, but the entire universe as well, the physical universe. And that's the manifestation. So in other words, the idea is that the Rebbe Shlomo brought into operation. As a result, he willed it, and the operation of Tzimtzum came about, and there was a new act of Hester. But that act of Hester was a split, sort of. It brought being capacity-wise to 80% level, which is far greater than the Malachim. Yet when he actually actualized the being, he made him 20%. So therefore, they are choser. There's a chesson in that being, because the capacity of that being is really 80% of God's power. Choser, deficient.
Deficient.
They are now deficient in terms of what they could be. That's called a chesson, a deficiency. So in other words, man's shleimus or perfection is 80%. That's the reflection of his true being, in terms of that's the state that God created him as. But when he actually created him, the actuality of it, of course, is choser, chesson, which is deficiency. He now is only the 20% level of God's power. So it comes out that man is tremendously deficient in terms of what he could be. So that's a third act, and the second kind of being God created. In other words, either beings are perfect in terms of what they could be, or beings are deficient in terms of what they could be. All beings are deficient in terms of God, and all beings are deficient in terms of what God could have created. But once you get away from those two ideas, there are two kinds of beings. There's a spiritual universe which is perfect in terms of their capacity, and there's a physical universe which is deficient in their capacity. So it comes out that the physical universe is a manifestation of the third Tzimtzum, which left mankind and his universe completely deficient, or very much deficient, in terms of the capacity he could reach, in terms of his shleimus, which is 80%. So that's the third act of Tzimtzum, okay? Is this differentiation. So it comes out that there's two kinds of beings God created. One, besides the fact that they are at different levels of his powers, right? One being, which is the spiritual universe, is Malach and Chayas and all these spiritual ideas and so on. He created them perfect in their capacity. It means they're at a certain given capacity, and they're perfect. Then he created a second kind of being, which is deficient in terms of their capacity. Not only are they deficient in terms of God's, obviously, perfection, but they don't even measure up to their own perfection, their own capacity. Two kinds of beings. But the being he created at the second kind of level is greater in capacity than the spiritual universe, yet less in actuality than the spiritual universe. So he's greater and less at the same time. So it comes out the Rebbe Shlomo creates a being which is choser, deficient in his very being. And the whole world is deficient with him. That's the state of Third Tzimtzum. Now, what does the Rebbe Shlomo now do? What does he now do? He now gives this third Tzimtzum, which makes beings deficient in terms of their own capacity, right? And he gives the operation over to mankind. Okay? Now let's see what happens. So it comes out like this. The subject is man. The operation, or rather the mechanism of how he controls Tzimtzum is the Avodah. Remember? Mitzvahs, Tshuva, and Yisurin is the mechanism that controls Tzimtzum. Okay? Either Tzimtzum meaning either Ha'or or Hester, either way. Means the amount of God that he reveals or conceals is the process of Tzimtzum. Man now controls it through the Avodah, through the Mitzvahs, Tshuva, and Yisurin. And man controls the amount of presence or absence of God's presence in this universe by the Mitzvahs, Tshuva, and Yisurin. Those three ideas which forms the totality of the Avodah. So the Avodah is nothing more, wait, than a mechanism which will control the amount of absence and presence of God in the universe. That's Tzimtzum. You see? Now, the effect of this Tzimtzum that man is controlling, it's like a dial. The God gives over the dial to mankind. That dial is the Avodah. Okay? And the Avodah means that if man does mitzvahs, he increases the presence. He diminishes Simsim, which means he increases the presence of God. That's the effect. If he does Avera, so he does the other way, he turns the dial the other way, which means that he increases the Hester, okay, the concealment of God. Now, what is the result of concealment and presence of God in terms of man's control of that dial? Now, man can do one of two things. Remember, man was created in the physical universe, and the universe itself reflects a certain amount of deficiency. Remember the third act of Simsim? That God creates the universe with a capacity of 80 and the deficiency of 20. And then he says, okay, that's the given. He now takes man and he puts him in that universe. Now, man who now can control further the presence or absence of God, which in effect means that there's more presence or absence of God in the effect, what it really means is that he controls deficiency in the universe, because the result of Hester is what? Is perfection or Shlemus. That's how beings are more perfect, because God reveals himself more to those beings, and beings are less perfect because God hides himself from those beings. So in other words, if you control Tzimtzum through the Avodah, the effect of the Tzimtzum, of course, is there's concealment or presence of God in the universe. But the result of that is that if you increase the Chesaron, the deficiency, by doing Averis, which is your mechanism, then lo and behold, you actually create greater Chesaron in the universe. So you're doing what's called a fourth Tzimtzum. You yourself are now adding greater deficiency, which God himself never did. You actually are now introducing the fourth stage of Tzimtzum. If you do the mitzvahs, so therefore you turn the dial the other way, which is what? More presence of God. That's the effect. Then the result of that is greater perfection in the universe. You're now getting closer to your 80. So man can either decrease the original Tzimtzum of God, the third act, or he can initiate a fourth act. And his starting point is the universal starting point of 80% capacity and 20% deficiency. So either he goes down another 10% if he keeps going down, or he does less. The 20, 30, 40, and so on, he goes more. So it comes out that there are four ideas of Tzimtzum, where God is a subject three times. First act, to let beings exist. The second act is the kind of beings. The third act is that the beings themselves are now split. Their capacity is now far greater than the potential. Then he says, okay man, you now have that control. But so what's your mechanism? The Avoda. So if you do the mitzvahs and so on, you create more Ha'ora. It means the Tzimtzum gets less, so God gets more revealed. So therefore you create more Ha'ora, more revelation of God's presence, which automatically makes mankind and his universe more perfect. Starting to go back to the 80. So therefore you are undoing the third symptom of the Ribbono Shel'olam. You see, you're undoing what he did. If you don't do that, if you do the Averis or whatever, then what happens is you reverse the process. And as a result of the effect, which is more Hester, the manifestation or the result of that Hester is that the universe with man together becomes less perfect, more deficient. Forget about how it manifests itself, but let's just get those ideas. So in other words, you are introducing a fourth act of Hester. You're bringing the universe and yourself to even greater Hester than even God intended or did. So therefore, you are responsible for what's called the fourth act of Tzimtzum. God did the first three, and you're doing the first four. God is the subject of the first three, and you are the only the subject of the last one. So therefore, that's the way it goes. Either man increases the Hester, that's the whole business of this world. Either you increase the Hester, which means you do Averis, whatever, and therefore the universe gets more and more imperfect, which means greater and greater deficiency, because the far God gets away from you, the more deficient you get. Or you do mitzvahs and you increase the Shlemus, the perfection, okay, by doing the mitzvahs, which increases the Ha'ora, the revelation of God. You therefore increase his presence, and the result of that is that you somehow become more mishtalim, you're perfect. That's what's called tikkun, masakin. God wants man to fix the universe and himself, which means to do mitzvahs, undo the third act of Tzimtzum. Not to makalkel, means to further the act of Hester, which means to increase Tzimtzum. That's what tikkun and kilku really mean. The subject of the first three phenomena of tzimtzum is God. He did it by way of his will. That's his mechanism. The operation that God did three times is tzimtzum, which means restrict some aspect of his being, okay, which is not literally, it means subjective to the individual himself. It means you perceive less of him. The effect of each act of tzimtzum is a further reduction in ha'ora, or a greater amount of hester, concealment of his presence. The result of all three, okay, is that there was first the possibility of beings being created. The second was beings being created at a certain level. And the third result was that there would be a being now created whose capacity and his actuality is now different. And the manifestations of all three, the first manifestation of the first symptom is that there's a possibility of others to exist. The second manifestation is the spiritual universe. And the third manifestation of all this is the idea of the physical universe, which means man and his universe. Now, mankind now is given over that last idea. So therefore, man now is a subject. His mechanism is the avodah. The operation he controls is the tzimtzum, which means God getting closer or far from the universe. The effect of this tzimtzum is always more presence or less presence. And the result of all this is either man makes more deficiency in the Bria, greater chesaron, which is a new fourth symptom, he's adding to the deficiency that God himself put, or the reverse. That man reduces the third act of symptom, makes less deficiency, and begins going back to the level of his capacity, which is greater than the malachim. Now, just to mention something, which we've mentioned further on later, is that each man has a specific idea in that dial. That we don't all have identical dials. It's identical because we can increase or decrease the amount of hester. In that way it's identical. But hester itself can manifest itself in many ways. The multiplicity of God, which is the opposite of the oneness of God, is manifested in many millions and millions of different ways. Each man is given one way to undo the hester in that particular idea, and that's his particular dial. In other words, it's basically the same dial doing the same hester, but it's sort of like a different color than everybody else's. Everybody's responsible to either increase deficiency or decrease deficiency in a certain aspect of hester. You see? So that's each individual's personal contribution to the Bria. But the idea is that man either increases the hester or decreases the hester, which means he increases the chesaron or he decreases the chesaron, the deficiency, and therefore he goes to shlemus. When man does mitzvahs and therefore increases the amount of revelation, therefore he becomes more perfect, we then say he's being misakin the Bria. And you understand why it's takatikun. He's correcting the Bria because it's deficient. God purposely made it deficient at a certain point. When we see man then does the reverse, introduces hester, concealment of God's presence, and as a result there's greater deficiency, we say that man is makalkal the Bria, that he's destroying more, damaging, because he's increasing the amount of deficiency that was started off in the first place. That is like a little sum total of the ideas of tzimtzum that I spoke about previously. Now, in other words, the idea of tikkun, when we talk about tikkun, you know what we mean? You know what tikkun means? Tikkun means bringing God back into the universe, which he has originally gone out of. But he went out for a purpose. He wants you to bring him back. And automatically, your bringing him back takes away your chesaron. Because the closer he gets to you, automatically you change. You become more perfect to reflect his nearness. It's like a cause and effect that must be. Now, let's understand. Now let's go over the different ideas that I had discussed until now. And let's tie them all together. The different ideas that I'm now going to tie is, first of all, the idea of oneness of God as the pivotal principle. The second idea is the reward a person gets. The third idea is what is the task of man. The fourth idea is the mechanism that man has and how is it related to the task and so on. And then the fifth idea, okay, is the matzav of Nisoyan that he's in. Okay? Now, to understand these ideas, we can now relate them all together. I had said previously that the idea of oneness is a pivotal principle. Why? Because oneness means the only thing you can comprehend about him is his oneness. Because you can understand oneness by the negation of its opposite. In other words, if you look at multiplicity and you negate that, obviously what's left is oneness. So therefore, what you will be masig in Olam Haba is God's oneness, his Yehuda. That's what you actually comprehend, that aspect of his oneness. So therefore, oneness itself becomes the schar, Yehudai, Hasagas Yehudai. Hasagas Yehudai means the comprehension of his oneness is what's the reward in Olam Haba. Okay? And that becomes the pivotal principle for everything else. The second idea is the reward, is what I'm mentioning. That the reward is the comprehension of his oneness. Now, interestingly enough, the fundamental operation in the universe, which is Simson, is exactly the opposite, that every time God hides his oneness, then what happens is more things get more and more deficient. Okay? Because the only way we can relate to God is through his oneness. But what also is the only reason the way we get our perfection is by being closer to him. But the only way you can be closer to him is by being closer to his oneness, because that's all we can grasp of the Ribbono Shel Olam. So in other words, being next to God is synonymous with being next to his oneness, which is less hester. Being away from God, which is the same thing as saying being away from his oneness, in other words, being more, living more in plurality, automatically is the same thing as saying as being more deficient. In other words, our whole claim to the Ribbono Shel Olam is only his oneness. Therefore, if he varies that oneness, that itself varies our perfection or imperfection. That's exactly what it is. Therefore, we understand now that oneness itself is the fundamental pivotal principle of the universe. The idea that the Schar Olam Haba is really a hasoga, a comprehension of that oneness of God, because that's the only way we can understand him. So that's the Schar. The mechanism, or rather, that's the Schar. Now, since the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted us to work for our reward, right? That was the original Shurim, that he wants us to work for the reward. So then it must follow that God must create a certain task to do, right? But if everything is perfect, then there's no deficiency, so then what's there to do? A task means that something is deficient, so you can say, do that. So what the Ribbono Shel Olam created as the task, or as the situation, is the chesaron. So God creates man deficient, and his universe deficient. He gives him an 80% capacity, and he gives him a 20% actuality. There is now a wherewithal. There is now a situation in the universe which now is deficient. So that's the situation of the universe, is hester, or chesaron. The mechanism, God now gives man a mechanism and says, look, I will give you the wherewithal to undo that chesaron. Undo that deficiency and become perfect. And that's the mitzvahs. And you'll recall that I said mitzvahs, tshuva and yisurim, all reflect, they're all magal yehudai. Well, because it's all the same thing. The mechanism itself testifies to the unity of God. Therefore, in effect, what it does to the universe is it brings in the unity of God. That's why it's a perfect mechanism. It's not like a dial, it has nothing to do with the workings of a machine. The mechanism is testimony of Gil Yehudai, which I had mentioned in a shir. Therefore, the results of that mechanism is what? Is more Yehudai in the Bria. So therefore, we now see that the reward of man, which is Hasogas Yehudai, we see the situation that man finds himself in, which is a Hesti Yehudai, concealment of God. We see that the actual mechanism is making God more apparent through the Avodah, and that's all it does, is make God, when we testify to God's unity. So the Avodah itself is an actual mechanism that reflects his Yehudai. It's a testimony that God is one. So we see that's the same. In addition to that, besides that we now see the idea of his oneness, we see the Schar, which is a comprehension of his oneness, right? We see the mechanism, which is a testimony to his oneness. Right? What's the fundamental operation? Is his oneness in the universe or out of the universe? That's a tzimtzum. Tzimtzum is the actual operation of his oneness being apparent or his oneness not being apparent. So the actual operation itself, the fundamental operation, is tzimtzum, which is nothing more than his oneness being apparent or not. So, because the effect of tzimtzum is always, is there more hester, more concealment of God's presence, or less concealment of God's presence? So the fundamental operation controls that state of tzimtzum itself. But that's really what the mechanism, and that's really what the schar is, and that's what the pivotal principle. So I've now related four ideas together. Okay? Now, so therefore, man can now, by the operation of tzimtzum, now effect or accomplish his task. And what's his task? Shlemus. That's what his task is now. The task of the mitzvahs is to be mashlim himself in the universe. Somehow to get rid of the deficiency that the Rosh Hashanah placed in and come up to his full capacity. But unfortunately, man does the reverse. The opposite happens, that man is busy creating a hester, therefore making himself and his universe much more deficient. So we've related several ideas together as really being all manifestations of the same idea, that the oneness itself is the principle, because that's all we can comprehend of God. The reward that we get in Olam Haba is the comprehension of his oneness. Okay? That's the actual oneness itself, the reward. The situation of the universe, the third idea, is a hesti yichudai. The situation of the universe is a concealment of his presence. Therefore, a task now appears. The task is to bring his presence back into that which was concealed. That's why God created a being that was both. So there should be a task, and therefore his work, his job would be, or rather should be a situation of deficiency, and his job would now be the reverse, undoing that deficiency. So that's the fourth idea. The mechanism is a fifth idea, and that's how he can do it. And the fundamental operation, of course, is tzimtzum. That is the actual process itself. That is basically what happens. I've related all the ideas of the previous shurim into one. Okay? That everything really revolves around one idea, and that's, of course, his unity, his Einei Mirvado. And everything is set up on that basis. Beings come into existence because of Einei Mirvado, that God creates a certain kind of being, that there's a difference in his perception of Einei Mirvado, in his capacity, which is 80%, and in his 20%, which is much less perception of his Einei Mirvado. And therefore, we now have a deficiency of Einei Mirvado. Therefore, Rebbe Yishlom wants man to perceive more of Einei Mirvadoi, and automatically he will then become more perfect as a result. That's why the actual effect of his of man's work is a shlemus in himself, which automatically means getting close to God. It's the same thing. The work itself, the effect of the work, and the reward, it's all the same. It's all united in the same idea. And that's really the task of man, is tikkun, not kilkul, to undo the chesaron of the universe and not to increase the chesaron. And he does that by virtue of the mitzvahs, and he's placed in a situation which is imperfect in order to undo the imperfection. See, it's all one idea. If man does mitzvahs, what are we saying here? That man and his universe will then get less deficient. How do you see that reflected in man? The answer is you don't. And the reason why is that is one of the things that Adam Rishon did because of his chet. What Adam Rishon did as part of his chet, which we'll talk about when we get to Adam Rishon, the sin, is that no more could the manifestation of your acts be apparent to you. Not at all. It means even if you were a tzaddik gomor, you do not see your diminishing of chesaron in yourself and the universe at all. That itself was hidden from the Briah. Well, we'll talk about when we get to Adam. Okay, now, back to the idea of man himself increasing the chesaron if he does averus, which is increases the tzimtzum, increases the hester, increases the chesaron, it's all the same thing going on. Last week I had said that they must express itself in historical principles. The whole understanding of history is nothing more than result of man's actions. Now, when I mean man, I only mean whoever is in the agreement with God, meaning, before Avram Avinu, everybody controlled tzimtzum. Everybody. Everybody could either mesaken the Briah by bringing more God's presence, or mekalkel the Briah, destroy the Briah, everybody could do it. The Rebbein Shem then made a covenant, an agreement with Avraham, and said that you are the only one that now can do it, because now the whole Bria exists only for you. It means you are now the man that I wanted. You're the one who is willing to agree with my agreement. I'll give you Adam Abor, you do the mitzvahs. So Avraham Avinu and Jews, as a result of that, are the only ones now who control Tzimtzum. That which happened before Avraham Avinu, everybody can control Tzimtzum, and we'll understand that in a minute when we see what happened to Noach and his generation. Now, however, only Jews control Tzimtzum. Goyim can only affect Olam Hazeh. They can do nothing to bring the universe more perfect or less perfect. Either way, they can do nothing. They can only disturb Olam Hazeh itself. Well, they can affect only this world, but they cannot affect the ongoings, which we do not see, of the perfection or the deficiency of this universe. Only if they become Jews can they do this. But if they don't become Jews, then there's no way they can affect it. That is what it means to be a Jew. That in your hands lies the dial. That every time a Jew does something, some new act, if he does an Avera, that Avera is a Hester, remember, right? It's Masti Yehudai. So the manifestation of that is that some historical event must reflect that concealment of God in an event which will conceal God. For instance, if Jews do Averas, then maybe there's pogroms. How do pogroms conceal God's presence? Because that's a Chil Hashem. Because everybody knows that the Jews are the nation of God. So obviously, if any Goy can go and wipe out the Jews, what does that say about God? Say, you know, he's not there, or where is he, or we're stronger than you. But the reason why that could happen, why the Goy could do that, is because the Jews did Chatoim, which increased the Hester, concealment of God, right? Which resulted itself in greater deficiency, which manifested itself in this universe as some historical event must succeed to express that Hester, which means that in this particular case, Goyim are now killing Jews. That's the way it goes. The fundamental principle of all history then is, does the historical event reflect God's concealment, express it, or reflect His presence? So therefore, if man does mitzvahs, and then what you see events happening is events which express his revelation. You know what kind of events those? All of a sudden some millionaire says he wants to donate $1 million to a yeshiva. Because those kind of events bring forth the revelation or presence of God. The opposite is when a millionaire says, look, I want to give it to Hollywood to make a motion picture or something like that. Those events conceal his will. Or when you see Wall Street and the oil market or the oil companies and so on, the success of corporations and business in America, certainly now in America, before the Mashiach, reflects the incredible amount of Hester that has been going on as a result of the affairs of the Jews, and nothing more. And I had mentioned last week, getting down to this time, what the Rizhna had said. The Rizhna is one of the early Hasidim, and he said that the Hester, the concealment of the Rebbein Shalom, before the advent of the Mashiach, will be so great that it'll be like this, that if you have Eliyahu on Har Carmel, Eliyahu was on Har Carmel, and at that time, who was the real God? Baal or God? So Eliyahu set up two kabbonis. And of course, the lightning came down on Eliyahu's korban, so everybody said, Hashem Elokim. This is in the Nevi'im. So the Hester, the concealment of God, will be so great that it will be as if the lightning bolt will come down on the Mizbeach, the altar of Baal, which means that it's as if God is so removed from the Bria, as if he's agreeing with the incredible amount of evil and multiplicity. In other words, the Hester is so great that it's as if God is masking with all the evil in the universe, because he's supporting it, he's giving it success. But it's not because that's what people think. But it's not because he's giving it success. We who control Tzimtzum, we who have done the Averis, whatever, have made it possible for all this to happen, because the historical events must express themselves in what we have brought into the Bria or not. If we brought God into the Bria, then the historical event expresses itself where Yehuda is manifest. If we do Averis which express God's concealment, then what's manifest is his concealment, that historical events which hide must be expressed, which is what I went into last week. The whole idea of the atheism and the founding of religions and science, all these phenomena are Masti Zichud and the results of the Avera. Now, that's what the Rishna said, that the Hester is so great that in the end of time, before the Mashiach, there's so much evil all around, it looks as if that's exactly what God wants. Because not only does he support evil in that sense, but anybody who has a yeshiva, who is a tzaddik, whatever, has terrible luck. So God is not only for the Rishonim, that's what it looks like, but he's against the tzaddikim. So that's what is meant, that it looks like God is maskim to the Avodah Zarah, that tzaddikim are not matzliach, there's failure, and the Rishonim are moedig matzliach. This is what happens as a result of the Hester. Most people, when they learn Torah, they're into the halachas, right? How you fulfill the halachas, correct? They learn Gemara, the halachas, and so on. So therefore, but the idea is, what does the halacha do? That Hashkofa tells you that every halacha somehow has some control on that tzimtzum, which either brings God to existence or not, and this has repercussions in history. That, in order to know the rest of the design, you've got to know the blueprint of the architect. Like I said, you know, if you bring somebody to a building and show them one room, all he knows is that room. But I can show you the whole building without ever bringing you inside, and that's by showing you the whole architect's blueprint. Hashkofa is the blueprint of the universe. And from it, we see not only the study of halacha, but what the halacha does when you are mekayim it in the first place. And not only that, if you go deep enough, you begin to see exactly what this halacha does in history, and what aspects of Yehud it reflects or hides. That's the whole idea of Hashkofa. Let's understand certain ideas about what happened with Noach, right? Before Noach, the world had reached a certain madrego or level of Hashkosa, corruption, right? As a result of that corruption, God decides to destroy the universe, right? Or the world, and he leaves only one man. There are many questions which are difficult to understand, but the most obvious is, why in the world is he destroying his world that he created in the first place to receive his goodness? What's going on here? Okay. The answer to that is that if mankind, as a result of his hester, right, his simtzum, what happens if he is so master Yehudo, he does so many averas, that the hester must express itself in events, and the events of the world are so concealing of God that it's unlikely for the individual himself to be Berchel Toiv, to choose mitzvahs in the future. Is there any point in man continuing? No. Because man has reached a point in the Bria where there's such concealment as a result of his actions, where his test is now affected. There's no more test. In all probability, he will not be Berchel Toiv anymore. The odds, or the probability that he will choose a mitzvah instead of Avera, is almost nil. Because the setup of the universe is such hester as a result of his actions, that there's almost no test situation worth continuing the Bria for. Right? Therefore, God now says, look, I must destroy the world. Not because mankind, because he doesn't want man around or whatever. Because it reached a point where it was useless for man to continue. Because the whole point is man should be tested and then be either mashlim himself or whatever. But as a result of Hester, you could influence history, which I told you, Bezez, reflects that principle. So it's possible for man to get to such a madrega in the Bria that he no more is able to choose between good and evil. He'll only choose evil. So therefore, as a result of that, there's no more test in effect. So it's pointless to go on. So therefore, the Rebbeinu Shem said, I must destroy the world. But when the Rebbeinu Shem destroyed the world, he then swore to Noach he would no more do it again. But then what happened? If we assume that the reason why he destroyed the world was because man had reached such a low level of Nisoyan test that it's pointless to go on, so what do you mean God won't destroy the world? Man can still do that. So what? When God said he swore he won't be a Mabo, you know what he was really swearing? He said, I will no more allow man to affect the world to such an extent where it will reflect his Hester. It means the universe can only go down to a certain point of Hester, and that's it. Even though man's actions deserve that it go further down, God stops it at a point so man can still have free will and not free will. Because if he allowed man to have the complete control of tzimtzum, he again would reach the point where he destroys himself. So therefore, what the Rebbeinu Shlom did is he stopped that. Man can no more affect the universe, or he can no more control tzimtzum to such an extent where he can bring it down to a level where there's no test situation. So that God swore that he will not allow man to mitzamtzem him, God, to such an extent with his Hester. Mameli doesn't have to destroy the world. You see? And that's reflected in the rainbow. When you see the rainbow, what it simply means is that the world has reached such a state of Hester that it deserves to be destroyed if God had allowed you to control symptom totally. That's what it means. But since God took out some aspect of your control of that symptom, so you cannot master Yehudah so much, so therefore it remains a certain amount of Bechira left. There's still the test situation, even though it's much harder, but you cannot bring it to the end. You cannot. Because if you did, then God would have to destroy the universe again. So God changed his Anhoga, where no more do you control Tzimtzum completely. You now control it a tremendous amount, but there's enough stopgap where the universe will continue to operate in terms of there won't be such Hester, and you can then do mitzvahs or averus. Now that itself is a chidush that was never involved, because only after Noach did that happen. So you can only bring the Bria to a certain Hester and no more, or else God will have to destroy the universe totally, which he doesn't want. So therefore, in order for him to stop himself from destroying, he had to stop your control of Tzimtzum. So by understanding the idea of Tzimtzum, you now understand the ideas of Noach, what's really going on, at least partially. What really is going on, of course, is much more than that. That's an application of the understanding the whole ideas of Tzimtzum and how they come out in the Chumash. And if you look at Rashi in the Chumash, Rashi says there that the Rebbe Shem swore he won't destroy. He says that he won't bring Choshech and Ibud. What's Choshech? Choshech is the Hester, and the Ibud is what follows. So what I thought would be valuable is to go over in summary form all the different ideas that we have talked about in terms of the Rebbe Shem. Now, they seem to fall out, or they seem to come out as approximately 19 different ideas. Mm-hmm. If you have to have a number. Now maybe you'd want to organize them differently, or in terms of a different number or whatever. Whatever. But anyway, so I'd like to go over all 19, the different ideas, and this is really like a summation, like as I said, of all the shurim before. And this sort of like is what we believe, what we know about the Rabbanu Shalom. And each one of these, of course, is fundamental. And certain ideas, of course, in terms of ourselves, are more important because they form the basis of the entire universal structure. Now, the first idea, of course, is that we believe in the existence of a supreme being called the Rebbeinu Shlomo. Now, that itself is... That's the first idea, that we believe in his mitzius. We believe in such a being, that there is a supreme being, and that he does exist. Now, it's interesting, but the way we believe and why we believe falls generally into three categories. There are three different sources of our belief. The first source is called historical transmission. The second source is called logical proofs. And a third source is actual sensory experience. Those are three different ways that we derive our belief, our ideas. Now, this part is a little new, so, but I felt since I'm talking about the Messias of the Rebbeinu Shlomo, just to talk about how we derive these ideas. The first source that I mentioned was historical validity, or historical transmission. Now, the idea of history is a very interesting idea. If somebody ever asks you, how do you know, let's say that, as an American, how do you know George Washington lived? You never saw him, and of course he's right, you never did see him. So how do you know? Not only, of course, George Washington, how do you know anything happened in history? How do you know anything happened in the world? How do you know there's such a thing as Poland? You were never there. And you're certainly not there now. The idea, obviously, is that, first of all, we assume that people who are at present, at the time it's happening, can interpret correctly what was happening. Okay. And in addition to that, we look at the transmission of history itself. Now, how do we know there was such a person called George Washington? Because there was a person, or many people in his times, who saw that person, and they transmitted it to their children, and their children to their children, and so on. That's how we know there's a person called Yod Vashem. How do we know there was such a thing as the Roman Empire and so on? It's the same idea. Because historians or people wrote down the accounts which they experienced in their lifetime, and it was transmitted from generation to generation. That's called historical validity. That's a transmission of history. Now, what was the historical validity of Yiddishkeit? That there was a time about 3,300 years ago, 3,300 years ago, that the Ribbono Shel Olam appeared to a nation of over 2 million people, and he revealed himself. He didn't reveal himself through Moshe Rabbeinu, he revealed himself. Okay, he spoke to them directly. In other words, they experienced his true being in whatever they did, where they could. And those are the first two commandments of the Torah. That's why Torah does not add up to Taryag. Doesn't add up to 613. Torah only adds up to 611. Because the first two commandments was given by the Ribbono Shel Olam himself, not through the Torah. See? Now, those two commandments which were given by the Ribbono Shel Olam, that Anochi Hashem Elokecha, and there shouldn't be any other God before you, was given directly by the Ribbono Shel Olam, and it was so awesome that the Medrash says that all Klal Yisrael died. Everybody died. It was such an incredible experience that they all died. And then the Medrash says, which I'll speak about later at some future point, what that all means. But in any case, the Rosh Hashanah did reveal himself to Klal Yisrael. Now, over 2 million people witnessed that revelation, that experience, okay? And they transmitted it down to their children. In addition to that, they also wrote it down in a book called the Torah, this historical event. And every generation, the individuals of that generation know this to be true, or they know that experience happened, because first, their fathers told them that the book that they have was given to them by their fathers, which was given to them by their fathers, and so on, all the way up back to the original experience. And that their fathers told them that there is a God, and so on and so forth, and he took the Jews out of Mitzrayim, and how does he know? Because his father told him, and how does he know? His father, all the way back the line. It's the same historical transmission that happens throughout. So therefore, when we say that you must be maimon, you must believe in God, or you must believe in his Torah, emunah means historical transmission. It means Kabbalah, the actual tradition that we receive, which is based on historical validity. Now, that historical validity is valid. That's how we believe all of history. We've never experienced anything like that. But it's called belief. Because I believe something to be true based on this line of transmission, even though I have never experienced it by myself. Now, if you look at the quality or the kind of history that happened in Yiddishkeit, you'll see it's very different than that happened in all other religions. Yiddishkeit says that over 2 million people, because it was 600,000 males from 20 and above, and we're assuming that if they were all married, at least 400 families, 2,400,000, there was over 2 million people in the desert. And the Torah says, or the transmission was, is that all these people received Torah from the Ribbono Shel Olam himself, and they witnessed the miracles and so on, everything that went about. So to what Judaism says, the historical validity of Judaism says, that the entire nation witnessed the event called prophecy, or a direct experiencing of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Not one or two people. If you look at other religions, for instance, take Christianity. Christianity says that there was one individual, Yeshua, who said that he was somebody, I'm a Mashiach, whatever, and they made him to a god later on, which, anyway, but he said he was somebody, and he had no proof whatsoever of his statement. Okay, and the major thing that they base it is that he was resurrected. And who was the one who saw him come back to life? And itself, that itself has many different versions in the New Testament, is a sick woman called Mary Magdalene, who they themselves will say that she's psychotic, she's a depressive. Their tradition of what they call belief is based on the ramblings of maybe one or two or three individuals. that say they saw this happen. Now, if you look at the probability that three people can be in error, or one person can be in error, as opposed to the probability that over 2 million people can be in error, assuming that the transmission was valid. We're not going into the transmission now, we're going into the original experience. Of course, there's no dimming. It's preposterous. There's not even a dimming. So that's the first, is that the actual event which was transmitted, compared to Christianity, it's absurd. That's the first idea. In addition to that, if you take a look at Mohammedanism or Islam, what was their tradition? That what's his name, Muhammad, was visited by God or whatever, angels, whatever he said he was on. And he himself said he experienced this revelation. No other man experienced this revelation besides him. And he went out and he said that God spoke to him or whatever and so on. He's the greatest prophet or whatever. And he then went about trying to make people believe of this experience. And of course, that also has a historical transmission. The experience itself, plus the transmission, is transmitted by every Arab to their kids and so on and so forth. But what was the original experience? Based on the hearsay, the ramblings of an ignorant individual called Muhammad, couldn't even write. And of course, most of they did not accept him in the beginning, so of course he did what usually you accept him, he butchered everybody else. And after a while, he went around slaughtering people who didn't believe in him. And of course, after a while, everybody began to see the light, and they began to believe in him. Now, it was more expedient to believe in him, obviously, than not, though. Anyway, so again, the major... Now, other religions, again, the major idea is that the historical experience is very different in Yiddishkeit than all others. And the Rabbeinu Shlomo, of course, realizes that. That's why he was Megala himself, or revealed himself to Klal Yisrael, even though they were not spiritually ready. They had no right to experience the Ribbono Shel'olam in their level. Because that kind of a revelation needed a much greater man, a much greater tzaddik. Klal Yisrael did not have the schus to receive that kind of revelation. But the Ribbono Shel'olam did it anyway, because he had to establish the historical experience which would then become transmitted. So therefore he revealed himself out of all proportion to the merits of the people in order to begin that. Now that's a very important idea, that one of the major basis of our belief is historical validity. And that's called immunah. So that's historical validity, which is, and therefore immunah is based on historical validity. Now, the next idea or derivation of the existence of the Ribbono Shel Olam, and of course all other matters, is called logical proofs. Now, I don't want to go into here what are the logical proofs of God and so on and so forth, because one has to be more astute logically, and it's not good because then you'll fall back on the proof and so on. But all I'm mentioning is that there are proofs, logically, which point to the existence of a God. Not certainty, only logically. Okay? There are certain proofs. I imagine the most famous proof of all is called the proof of design, which means that everything you view is established in such a way where it fulfills a purpose. That's the proof of design. In other words, to put it differently, it's like the famous, it really comes from the Medrash of the Gemara. If you walk into the desert, in a famous example, if you went into the desert, right, and you took a look and you saw in front of you, okay, let's say an IBM 360 computer, which is a very complex instrument, even though it's small. It has hundreds of thousands of different pieces. Each one has to act in the right way, in the same time, and so on, or else the thing doesn't work. And you walk, and let's say you understood what a computer was, and you ask yourself, there's only one of two ways this computer could have been here. You know how? Either it was placed there by an intelligence, or it evolved through chance. There's only one of two ways. You would of course say that it was obviously an intelligent being that did it, because this could never have come about through chance probabilities, given any amount of time. You walk in the desert and you saw the World Trade Center sitting in front of you. You would never say that this building evolved. That's preposterous. Nobody would say that, because it is so complex, and the complexity is designed so well that it performs a perfect function. I'm not talking about now if it was designed that way. I'm merely saying that you are encountering a World Trade Center which is beautifully integrated and designed and performs a perfect function. Now, if you see, if you look at yourself and you see the human body, which is infinitely more complex than the World Trade Center, and it's obviously infinitely more complex than the IBM computer, and we don't even know, we know a millionth of what goes on in the body, in terms of the brain especially, and nobody in his right mind would ever say that evolution made us. But I'll talk about evolution a little further down the road. But anyway, so therefore, one comes to the conclusion that the fact that everything is so designed in complexity to be able to accomplish a specific function so perfectly is proof that it was made only by an intelligent being. As a murdic proof, and not only as a murdic proof, but the Chazal used that, because somebody once asked, I think it was Rabbi Akiva, he said to Rabbi Akiva, how do you know there's a God? So Rabbi Akiva said, what happens if you go into a store and you see all the baking materials, the pans and so on, what would you assume? So of course I know it's a baker. He said, well, look at the Bria, the world testifies to its maker. Just by the design, that it testifies to the incredible intelligence of a being outside of it. Okay, anyway, that's an example of a logical proof or demonstration. Of course, there's been people who argue and say, look, but it could have happened maybe. You know, there were kinds of, retort and so on. But anyway, it's merely a logical proof. The third way of that we know of the existence of the Ribbono Shel Olam is because of actual things we experience in our lives. If you're a prophet, you experience Nevi'ahs. If you are a tzaddik, you get Ruach HaKodesh. Okay? Unfortunately, we don't really experience Ribbono Shel Olam in that way, that we could say, I've experienced Ribbono Shel Olam himself, However, there are certain events which we can see happen that are truly miraculous, and that they are unique in all history. And I'll give you several of them. The existence of the Jewish nation, the contributions of the Jewish nation, and the influence of the Jewish nation is abnormal. It means there's no demonstration like it in all of creation. What do I mean? For instance, the existence of the Jewish nation. No nation has ever lost its land and been gone into an exile and has lasted more than a couple of years. It's unheard of. The phenomena that Klai Yisrael has gone through is unheard of in all history. There's no nation that has ever duplicated it. All of the nations, after they became assimilated, disappeared. There's no such thing as a Roman left, an Egyptian. None of them are true Romans. There's no Egyptians or Arabs and so on. There's no pure race anymore. The only one who is still around, who can trace his lineage all the way back, again, by historical validity, is the Jewish nation. That is a phenomenon which is not duplicated by any other nation on earth. One strange idea. And many people have to believe in the uniqueness of the Jews merely by their existence. Because it's not a phenomenon you encounter other than the Jewish nation. That's number one. The second is the contribution of the Jewish nation is unheard of. 33% or something like that of all Nobel Prizes were won by Jews. When you think of the fact that one half of 1% of the world's population is Jews, and then you talk about the contributions of the Jews to mankind, it staggers the mind. If you removed all Jewish contributions, I don't even know what this world would look like, because you'd have to remove the Torah, you'd have to remove Yeshu, which is the beginning of Christianity, right? And because he was a Jew, right? You'd have to remove Marxism, because he was Jewish. You'd have to remove Freud, you'd have to remove Einstein, you'd have to remove the whole, you'd have to remove, the civilization will probably go back to the primitive times, whatever. That's to what extent the Jews have contributed to civilization. Now, how could a nation who is so small, one half of 1% of the world's population, have contributed something which is so out of their proportion? There are more Zulus in Africa than there are Jews in the world. Yet there's no nation on earth that can compare themselves with the amount of contributions that the Jews have made. It's staggering. You don't realize how little Jews are. 14 million people is a joke. There's 600 million Christians. You have no idea how little the Jewish people are. You're fooled by the third idea. That's the influence of the Jew.
Yeah.
For some, that's what you're fooled by. So it sounds like the whole, in fact, they say in America, the whole America is full of Jews, You think out of 220 million people, 200 million must be Jewish. Wait a minute, how can 5 million control 210 million people? But the idea is, in truth, that the influence, for some reason, of the Jew is incredible, out of all proportion to his number. and especially in today's world events, it's incredible that the Jews influence world history out of all proportion to their numbers. I mean, it's if they're like ants in this bria in terms of numbers. Okay, those three ideas itself is mamish nisim v'nifloyes. So we experience that. Besides the fact that we experience the idea that in no nation on earth has ever gone to exile for 2,000 years and has gotten their land back, there's no such phenomenon. No nation on earth has ever lost their language, Hebrew, and is now speaking Hebrew. There's no language on earth that has been dead 2,000 years as a spoken language and now is spoken again by millions of people. These phenomena are unheard of. Now, they themselves are not truth in that sense, but we ourselves at least can witness certain incredibly different phenomena which tells us there's something going on. And when we see in the Chumash that the Rosh Hashanah says himself that even though I'll throw them in exile, lima astim, I will not abhor them to destroy them, adraba, I will make sure that they still exist, the Chumash itself, the Torah itself tells what's going to be in the end of days, and so on. Anyway, that's basically the ideas of what we call the Emunah, or rather, or how we understand much of what, how we believe in. If we believe in something as a result of historical transmission, it's called Emunah. If we do it as a result of logical demonstration, it's called Yediyah. No, that's why the Ramchal, if you look in the beginning of the Sefer, says, Kol Ish Mi Yisrael, every Jew, Sarach has to Yamin V'Yeda, he has to believe and know that there is a God, and so on, and it continues. What do you mean, Yamin V'Yeda, you gotta believe and know? Because Emun is historical transmission, and Yediyah is his own experience, either because of his mind, or because of his actual encounter. And therefore, our religion is based on those kind of ideas, and they're very strong as a result. I maybe just want to digress into the existence of God, how we know. If you want to just go into why the exile should have destroyed the Jewish nation, there are many reasons. For the mere fact that we are subjugated, we don't have a place of our own, automatically would make us cease to exist, because what you do is you become assimilated into the culture and values of the nations you're in. Forget about the fact that they tried to destroy you at the same time. There are many facts, the nest of the exile has many ideas in it. But certainly the idea that Goyim have been trying to kill Jews for the last 2,000 years, you know, and the last guy who attempted it, of course, was Hitler, and he almost did it, okay? And of course, he, you know, in the sense that, and the truth is, he, in a certain sense, he did do it.
Yeah.
Because he destroyed what can never be returned. But anyway, but I'll talk about when we get to the Mashiach. But anyway, certainly that itself is the nest. Not only Jews were assimilated, Jews have been in the culture of other nations and so on, and Jews have been, they couldn't hold that and so on. In other words, as a result of the fact that they held their own values, they were not given privileges by Goyim. Had they assimilated, it would be much better off for them. At least they would have thought that, right? But the fact that the Goyim have tried to kill them itself brings even more so the fact of their existence is a nest nidlum. Okay?
Did God?
In any case, that's what I mean. So therefore, historical transmission is Emunah, logical proofs or demonstrations, and the experiencing in some way is called Yediyah. Okay? And in those two ways, we believe and we're maimon in the Ribbono Shel Olam and his Torah and so on. Now, so that's the first idea. We believe in the existence of a supreme being. The second idea is that his true essence, his true nature, is not knowable to any other being outside of himself. Only God knows who he is. We do not know and we cannot know who he is. Okay? So therefore, the knowledge of himself is not knowable to any other being outside of himself. That's a second major idea. So you can stop thinking about who God is, because you can never know. That's why when they say that the Torah was started with the letter Beis, right? Letter Beis. Why Beis? Because Beis is closed on three sides, right? Top, back, and down, right? It's and only the side, the left side is it open, right? What that means is that do not think above, before, or down. Only think straight ahead. Why? Because what you will be attempting to do is trying to think of who God is, and that's not knowable. So therefore, any conclusion you will reach by definition must be wrong, because it's contradictory. You know, if it's true that only God knows himself, then you cannot know him, so therefore any conclusion you reach must be wrong. So therefore, you're not allowed to think about that. You're allowed to think in terms of what we do, in terms of what his attributes are, in the way he projects himself to us, which is what I've said many times. But his atzmusoi, what he etzem is, nobody knows, nobody can know. So therefore the Beis points in the direction of the Torah and says, if you want to understand God, it's only within the framework of this existential system which the Rosh Hashanah created. We can perceive him from our system. Not outside the system. What Moshe Rabbeinu tried to do is he tried to get something which is incredible. You know? The two most fundamental knowledges of all, and not only that, it's the greatest mysteries of all. You know what the two greatest mysteries of all are? I'm meaning absolutely. The greatest mysteries of all time, all place, you know what that is? Is two. Who is God in truth, and why does he act the way he does? What determines his behavior? There's nothing more mysterious or more fundamental than that. And Moshe Rabbeinu, as soon as he saw that he had the opportunity, because by the Egel he saw the Roshim, there was a mokum of chesed, that Moshe Rabbeinu could zero in on that, he asked the Roshim those two questions. He was very intelligent, Moshe Rabbeinu. He knew what to ask at the right moment. First he asked, Hareini nor es derechecha, show me your ways. Means, tell me why you act as you do. What's your motives? Give me, make sense to everything you do. Which is really saying, explain to me why everything is. Because everything is the acts of God. So what he's really saying, you know, he's not asking, tell me what reality is all about. Because reality is all a result of your acts anyway. Tell me what your acts are all about. What motivates you? What's the meaning behind it? So Rabbeinu, of course, said whatever he said. And then Moshe Rabbeinu asked the second question, which is more profound. Hareini mor kvodecha. Show me your covet. Who are you? Show me your glory. Who are you, the etzem? And the Rosh Hashanah answered, of course, no man can know, you know, can know me. In any case, but he did show Moshe Rabbeinu more about what's possible to be known about God than any man ever lived. That he did give Moshe Rabbeinu, you know. And obviously, from everything we've said, we know what Moshe Rabbeinu was masik. He's Yehudai, right? Because it's the only, remember, all the only thing you can be masik is the unity of God. So Rosh Hashanah showed him more of Achdusoi, of Yehudoi, of his Eneg Nevadoi, than any being who ever lived. But those are the two fundamental mysteries. So the second idea is that the true essence of the Rosh Hashanah is not knowable to any other being besides himself. The third idea is that God's true essence and his very existence, not only is it only knowable to God, but it's really knowable to God. God really knows who he is. Now that may sound like a very funny question, a very funny statement. What do you mean he knows who he is? Well, obviously I know who I am, but the truth is you do not know who you are. Nobody knows who they are, and I'll show you what I mean. You know who you are in the sense that you look at yourself, and you see a body, you see your certain weight, certain dimension, certain color, you know, you have eyes and so on and so forth, right? That's what you see you are. But are you in contact with existence? No, you're not in contact with your existence, only your essence, only that what you are. But there's a quality behind that that's making you be. You're not in contact with the existence. You don't even know what it is in you. You don't have that. Not only that, I'll tell you another thing. You're not even in contact with who you are because nobody knows what matter is. Take a look at this book. Okay? You'll notice that whenever I define something, I only define it in terms of its characteristics. I say it's white, it's got this, right, and so on. It's hard, it has weight, and so on, right? But all I'm talking about is the form that matter takes in this present position. I mean, there's something called matter, substance, right? But it looks this way. So when I define something, I define the form that this matter is taking now. So that's the way I define it. Yeah, but what's the matter if you took away the form? What's behind it? What is it? What am I hitting? Nobody knows. You can only look at something in the form, its color, its dimensions, its shape, right? even when you strip it down to its atom, right? But the atom is only also a form because it looks like an electron at some time. But what's in the what's the electron made up of? What's the proton made up of? What's behind? Because again, you only look in terms of its form. That electron has a negative charge, it has weight. Again, you're doing the same thing. You're looking at something by its characteristics, its properties. You're not into the real thing itself. What's the goof? What's the chomer of that form? And nobody knows. So you don't even know your own matter, let alone you learn the Rebbeinu's matter. So therefore, when I say that God knows himself, he knows himself completely. And he really knows his own existence, and he knows his own matter, what he really is. Forget about his form, if he has a form. You see? He has true, complete consciousness of every aspect of his being. And of course, this makes sense from what I said previously. That when we say that the Rebbeinu Shel Olam is poshut, simple, we mean four ideas. He, which means the true he, the identity, his existence, his essence, and his acts are all identical. They're all synonymous. In us, they exist differently, right? In him, it's identical. So if everything is identical, his consciousness is also identical with his existence. It's all the same thing. So of course, he's completely aware of himself. So it's almost like every atom has consciousness about itself, in a very crude mushroom. So therefore, again, that the true essence and existence of the worship is completely known to himself. Not only is he the only one who knows himself, but he knows himself completely. And we know ourselves almost nothing. We don't know who we really are. We don't know what matter is. We only describe the form. All definitions are about characteristics of an object, never about the etzem, the matter itself. Okay? So that's a third idea. The fourth idea is that God exists by himself. He doesn't need somebody else to exist in. For instance, if you take shape, the idea of shape. Shape is a being. There's an idea called shape. But did you ever see something that has shape and there's nothing there? No. A thing has shape. If you took the thing away, what would happen to its shape? It would disappear. Obviously, the idea called shape can only exist in something, right? So therefore it's called an accidental being, not accident. It's that kind of a thing. Those things which need something else to exist in is called an accidental being. For instance, the idea of perfection. There's no such thing as perfection. If you have something and that's perfect, therefore we say you're perfect. But the idea of perfection must exist in something. Something must be perfect. So therefore, the idea of perfection is called an accidental being. Because it doesn't exist by itself. It needs something. It merely is part of something else. So therefore, God is not part of anything. God exists completely by himself. As opposed to us, where we are all parts of God. If he was removed, we would cease. Because we are accidental beings. We emanate from him, so to speak. God exists of and by and for himself. He does not exist in anything else except himself. That's a fourth idea. A fifth idea is God is completely independent whatsoever, even about the things that we exist in. For instance, God does not exist in time. God does not exist in space. God does not have matter. God is not dependent even on the idea called substance. In other words, if there's an idea called substance, then God can exist because he now can have substance. No. You see, that's like a cha. You have to... There's an idea called substance, right? Substance is anything. Since there's an idea called substance, we now can have substance in the real world. No. Right? In the reversion, it's not true. God doesn't need the idea of substance and now he can exist and have substance. He gave rise to the idea, or created the idea of substance. So what is he? He's not substantial? We don't know. He's not matter, he's not time or space. So the Goshen is completely independent of all constructs, ideas that we need to exist in. If there was no space, we could not exist because we could not extend ourselves in any way. He can, or rather he doesn't need space. That's the fifth idea. The sixth idea is that when we talk about God's existence, we don't mean the way we mean ours. God must be. It means that his existence is necessary, or it's imperative. He must be. His existence is such where it demands to be. In other words, the annihilation or the non-existence of God is impossible completely. It cannot be in terms of existence. Of course, we don't understand what could be in something that makes it be. We have no idea. But his existence is necessary. That's called muchrach hamitzius. He must be. And his existence, he must be not externally because something else is making him be. No, intrinsically. Within him is the fundamental principle that makes him be. Not somebody else outside of him is making him be. Because then you can begin to think about that thing outside of him. What makes that be? Whatever. But the idea is that intrinsically, God's mitzius, his existence, is imperative or necessary. That's the sixth idea. The seventh idea is that God is perfect, absolutely. What does perfection mean? Perfection means is that there is nothing more to the concept than what God has. In other words, when we say God is wise, God is the totality of the concept called wisdom. There is nothing more to wisdom. If there was more, he again would have it. It's not like when we say that this. When we say if somebody's perfect, you know, we only mean relative. He doesn't contain the totality of that midah. He merely has a great deal of it relative to the next guy under him. You know, when we say he plays a perfect game of tennis, to use an example, you know, or he's a perfect game of chess, it doesn't mean that he's perfect. You know, but in reference to everybody else, he plays a perfect game of chess, whatever. But in reference to the true perfection. In chess playing, that's the example. Of course this individual doesn't reflect. The liberation of perfection is such where he has the totality of the concept. So therefore he is absolutely perfect. There is no deficiency whatsoever that he has. There's no change, there's nothing he needs. Whatever is, he has. And whatever isn't, he doesn't have because it isn't. Okay, so that's the idea of absolute perfection. An eighth idea is that just like his existence is necessary, his perfection is also necessary. In other words, God must be perfect. He simply must be perfect. Intrinsically, not extrinsically. It's not somebody else makes him perfect. Within him is the fundamental idea that makes him be perfect, and he must be perfect. Deficiency in the Ribbono Shel Olam is not possible. That's what necessary perfection means. We say that his perfection itself is necessary from within himself. He must be perfect. And that really, many people sometimes ask the question, well, why can't God, to show God can do everything? That's what perfection means. Why can't he create a stone he can't lift? The question is, well, can God create a stone he can't lift? The answer is no, so that he's imperfect. God is perfect. So you cannot say a being is imperfect because he cannot make himself imperfect. If God can create a stone that he can't lift, he would be imperfect. So how can we say that's his imperfection? You know the reason why God's imperfect? Because he cannot make himself imperfect. He can't even create a stone he can't lift. That's the opposite of the whole idea. You see? God can, you know, perfection itself, you cannot say something is imperfect because it can't deny its own perfection. That's a contradiction in itself. God is perfect, period. But he can't, but the idea is, his imperfection is not that he cannot make himself imperfect. That is his perfection. That he can't make himself imperfect. Anyway, let's go further on that. Now, the ninth idea is called Poshut. God is simple, and simple means, as I said, that he himself, his identity, okay, he himself, his existence, his essence means all his attributes, all his characteristics. And all his acts are all identical. There's no division whatsoever. It's one simple being, and from that being emanates four simultaneous from within that being. Like, it's almost like one bulb that emits many different kinds of rays. Yet in the bulb itself, it's all one thing. But when it leaves the bulb, it looks different. All these things in God is only one identity. And again, that's not understandable by us, because in our world, everything is split. We are different than our existence, which is different than the attributes, which is different than our acts. Everything is different in this world. Because this world is a world of what's called pirut, diversity, separation, distinction of entities. However, in the Ribbono Shel Olam, there's no distinction of entity. There's no distinction of any of his characteristics whatsoever from he himself. That's the ninth idea. The tenth idea is that he is one because there's no other God like him, and he is absolutely one. When I say that he is absolutely one, means that he cannot be duplicated existentially.
Or take another form.
That's different. In other words, God cannot be one. God is one in the sense that there is nobody like him, and he's absolutely one. That there can be no duplicate existentially of the Ribbono Shel Olam. There can only be one kind of being like God. Absolutely. That's what it means by his absolute oneness. So therefore he's an Echad, and he's also a Yochid. That is absolutely one. The 11th idea is that not only is God one and he's absolutely one, but he is the only one. He is the sole entity. Period. There is nothing else. Ein oid mu'vado. It doesn't say ein oid kamoyu, there is nobody like him. It says ein oid mu'vado, there is nobody besides God. Which means that even though we exist, obviously, however, compared to his existence, we are ayin. We don't exist. We don't exist compared to his existence. And I gave the example, for instance, like a dream and a dreamer. That a guy is having a dream, and in the dream you have people talking to each other. But would you say that the existence of the people in the dream is like the person himself sleeping? No. But as soon as the guy wakes up, the whole dream vanishes. It's the same idea, that in the dream itself, people are talking to each other. Right? They have the same kind of existence. But the one who's dreaming obviously has a different existence than the dream itself. That's a crude example. The same idea. We as compared to the Ribbono Shel Olam do not exist. Period. However, in our own terms, we do have existence. And it's a real world. And from that real world, we have to try to understand the Ribbono Shel Olam. But that is the idea. Einei Mevado. He is the sole entity, the only entity of all. That's the 11th idea. I'm going to tell you the next principle, and that is that the Ribbono Shel Olam is absolutely not comparable to any act of his creation. Right? That really throws it in. In other words, there is no aspect of creation. I don't care if it's time or space, matter, energy, form. I don't care what it is, color, shape, dimension, anything. God is not comparable whatsoever to anything. And I told you the pasuk because Yeshaya says, the Amit Damuni, who are you going to compare me to? The Eshved, I will be like. Vima Kodesh, says the Ribbono Shel Olam. That the Ribbono Shel Olam says through Yeshaya that no matter what you think I am, you're wrong, because I'm not comparable to anything that you know of, whatsoever. So automatically you see that God obviously is not in the guise of a human, because then you could compare him. Okay? So that's the 12th idea. That his absolute non-comparability whatsoever to the creation itself. The 14th idea is that he is the first being in terms of creation. That God is the first being, and then after God there emerged other beings. So in terms of creation, where you have many beings, forget about the fact that we don't really exist, but assuming from our standpoint, he is the first and we are the next. No, I'm just saying that he is the first, before anybody else. Okay, that's the 13th idea. The 14th idea is that he is the first cause of all creation. He brought everything into being. He gave existence to everything. So therefore, he is the true first cause of all creation. That's the 14th idea. The 15th idea is that he created and he continues to sustain that creation. Therefore, we need the active involvement continuously of God's creative act. Means our existence is such that if he left us alone, we immediately evaporate, disappear. So in other words, creation is a first act and it's a continuous act. That's why it says, "B'chadish b'chol yom tomid ma'aseh b'reishis." Because it's not only the act of initiation, creation in one shot, but God has to continuously create from microsecond to microsecond, or else we would cease. So therefore, the Roshim created and continues to sustain, which really means he continues to create again and again and again. Same thing, okay? That's what's known as existential involvement. That God is involved in the universe existentially. He gives it existence. It needs creation and an ongoing creation. That's the 15th idea. Now, the 16th thing is that he continuously supervises all of creation. In other words, nothing can happen in the entire universe, spiritual and physical, unless he consents. That's called his supervisional involvement. God supervises the Bria. Means whatever happens, even the movement of an atom to another spot, must happen because he's maskin. He approves of such a move. That's called supervisional involvement. The 17th idea is that not only must everything go in accordance to his haskama, his approval, but that he is the sole agent of the execution, even though it looks like other things, people are doing it. It looks like Malachim are doing many things, or you're doing it. But the truth is, he's the only one that does anything, period. And obviously, since he's Einod Mavadeh. So therefore, he is the sole agent that executes his will, and no other entity whatsoever, even though it appears or looks like other entities like Malachim are serving as his agents. That's called an interactional involvement. So God is involved in the universe existentially, he makes it be. He's involved in the universe supervisionally, means nothing can happen without his approval. And he's involved in the universe in an interactional basis. He gets into the universe and he does it. He doesn't give it to somebody else. He's the one who does it. And we know that, of course, because it says, "Anicha Hashem Elokecha asher hotzeicha me'eretz Mitzrayim." God says, "I am your God." What kind of a God? An interactional God. I went in there, pulled you out. Not like a God who's far removed and give it to other agents. Okay, so God is involved interactionally. And the 18th idea is that the Rebbeinu completely pervades and surrounds the universe. Totally. Moli kol ha'aretz kevodo. He's completely pervading the universe. And the last idea is that the fundamental personality principle of the Rebbeinu is his tuvah.